Father, we thank you so much for your delight in us, your communication to us, especially this couple that's working down there with these folklore. We are so blessed by the way you fashion people with such purpose, such determination, such care. We pray that you would bless their work, provide for their needs, and cause the revelation of your Son to redound to thanks and praise to him for all eternity because of their labors. We pray for our session today, Lord, that when we look at this universe that you have built for your Son, that we might see your handiwork, that we might understand more about your grace and your beauty, and that you would reveal the greatness of your design and your purposes for us as we look into your word and try to understand the wonders of your work. So we ask this for the sake of your Son, that we might cause more scraps of our praise to be put at his feet for all eternity. We ask it for his sake. Amen. Okay, we are on bus stop tour, and last week we started on the universe. And we just to review the points, we talked, first of all, that it was totally derivative and was created out of nothing. Remember, we practiced speaking a little tennis ball into existence. How many of you went home and practiced that a little longer? It was created by deliberate acts of speech. Remember, it was spoken into existence. One interesting thought about this that we speculated that it was music. I had somebody ask me during the week, did I really think God sang the universe into existence, or was it prose? And, if we're in rabid speculation mode, I would tend to think, because of the mathematical structure of the universe, the fact that it's elegant, just incredibly elegant from a mathematical standpoint, that it may have been musical. If you put those two together, you get music. At least you get poetry. At least you get poetry. So, I wouldn't be a bit surprised. The rabbis, of course, are convinced that he spoke Hebrew when he actually created. And there's an interesting argument for this. We'll cover this in no doubt next year sometime. It's in Bus Stop 3. That the pun that's played between man and woman, Ish and Isha, only works in the Hebrew language. So there is an argument that the rabbis made in the Mishnah that God must have spoken Hebrew, or else that pun would not have worked. But we won't come to that for a couple of months as to how we do this, okay? But it was created probably music or poetry. It is sustained by speaking. Everything is held together by his word. If he stopped speaking, it would be over. If he even sneezed, we would poof out of existence. We are that fragile. We are that dependent upon his speaking. We are that dependent upon this gracious God. If you said we are that dependent upon just God, that could be a horrible, terrible thing. It is a terrible thing to fall into the hands of the living God, consuming fire. But when you put the word gracious and good on the front of that word God, this thing, this universe, turns into a playground. It turns into a research lab. It turns into a sandbox. It turns into an exercise gym. It turns into a lot of things for us, but it is a beautiful place to do and sustained by his speaking. It is trivial by comparison. We talked about how he holds this thing, this little bitty marble-sized thing in the palm of his hand, looks down at it, and it's just trivial by comparison to our God. Okay. When we get to Bus Stop 3, we'll see that when he looks in there, there's some specific things he looks for. Remember when I survey the wondrous cross, where the whole rib? I'm not going to be able to get through that, actually. Where the whole realm of nature, mind, that would be a gift too small, far too small. Love so amazing, so demands my life, my soul, my all. Right? So when he looks into this vast universe, he's looking for some very specific things called people. See, these are the things that he's got. Trivial by comparison, it's a delight to him, a thing of beauty. He likes this stuff. Remember we talked about the first party in heaven, right, was at the end. Right? He set aside a whole day just to party, the seventh day, and he ceased and enjoyed his works. It's a gift to the Son. He literally made this for the Son. Now, there's a question about whether this was a surprise gift or not. Somebody came up and asked, but didn't he make it through the Son? Didn't he have Jesus create it? Absolutely. So the question is, did he tell Jesus ahead of time that he was going to give it to him? Right, but he did it. But he probably told it, obviously, since they don't share very many secrets up in the Trinity, especially before the incarnation, that you're going to make this yourself and it's yours. Now, I know when I asked my sons are my daughters to make something that they know they are going to own. It's going to be theirs to work to wax their car as opposed to my car. There's an incremental quality difference, I have noticed. Okay. I don't want to impugn, obviously, the son here. That's not the intent. But you understand that there's a certain delight. There's an investment that Jesus Christ has in this universe in so many ways. So many ways. So many ways. So it was a gift to the Son. It was created for us to marvel at and delight in. We're supposed to look at this stuff and say, wow, this is incredible. If you'll skip ahead, let me mention something, just to give you an example of this, because we won't get to this for a while. If you look at the universe, it tells us something about God. See? Something serious about a God who loves diversity, loves robustness, loves beauty, loves music. And look at the very last paragraph of this syllabus. The very last, and I want to read this slowly. Okay? It's on page 7. Those of you who don't know where the last page is. Okay, the last page is page 7. The last paragraph talks about how unnecessary so much of this variety is. It's just flat. We don't need this to get along. But look at this, just a partial list. Such unnecessary variety. Cinnamon, scarlet, a gentle breeze, unfolding sunset, the feel of cold water, the sound of a harp, the warmth from a fire, the tang of mustard, the loyalty of a pet, the smell of fresh clover, the looks of lovers, honeysuckle, the smile of an infant, the sound of gentle rain on a hot summer day, red ringlet hair, the clarity of the stars, the brooding of the ocean, a laugh, tears at reunion, wildflowers, the touch of silk, full moons in the fall, cool marble floors, a trumpet sound, and the Song of Solomon. See, this ought to tell you something about our God. He loves beauty, variety. He's a very sensual God, obviously, from all of this stuff. Nature is what we call verdant. Verdant. It is full, it is rich, it is green, it is growing. And He likes it, and it shows us something about His handiwork. Okay? We also looked at H, back to 2. It was orderly, but still open. We talked about that it's fixed laws, so as little toddlers, we wouldn't be always surprised at our changing environment. We could make sense of this world. We could go out and change the world. And remember, I challenged you at the end for you to go out deliberately and change the universe this week. For those of you that made a deliberate attempt to do so, you did it. For those of you that didn't make a deliberate attempt, you still changed the universe. You still changed the universe. You just didn't get as much leverage, perhaps, as you probably could have got with an intentional act. But it still changed nonetheless, one way or the other, right? It moves on, and what we do has consequences, okay? But it's orderly, but God can just, if He wants to make an axe head float, we talked about, wham, He'll do it. He doesn't do it on a regular basis, so we will learn to try not to drop ox heads in the water. Ox heads, yeah. Axe heads, yeah, excuse me. Remember about the elephants were going to melt with in the fervent heat? Right, same kind of deal. Same kind of deal. Elephants going to melt. That's right, those poor elephants. All right, so we are now at the universe is what we call finite, temporary, and troubled. In other words, it is not God. It is just not God. We talked about we fit here. And it is, with this deal, I don't live here in the universe, I'm just passing through kind of model. I always think about, every now and then I get this desire to, I use this metaphor about putting down roots. And I have to always remember that the thing is, Abraham put down tent pegs. See, it was a different thing. Roots have some value if you understand where they fit in life, because they have to do with community, how we build relationships. Those kind of roots you can still take up and move as the tent moves. See, relationships always go with you. As far as I can tell, I've been thinking about this for a while, the only two things that you can take with you on the other side are your character, apparently, and any of the relationships that you built that also were based upon that care. As far as I can tell, that's all you get to take with you, is what you have grown to become, what the Lord has done in your life, where you end up in terms of your character, and then any relationships that you've got with similar people. Those things survive death, absolutely. And we have to recognize that this is a transitional stage that we go through. It's difficult to focus on this when you're, you know, they say the sweet by and by versus the nasty here and now, right? And it's, we live in this nasty here and now. Somebody asked me after the first service how my week was in Colorado, and I said, effective. It was just effective. It was one of those kind of weeks. Okay. It has now become a slur term for everybody that was in the first service. We now know, how you doing?
Oh, I'm being effective.
Now we understand, right? Now we understand. Okay. But the universe is finite but unbounded. Now that's a technical phrase, which means you can go forever, but you never get out of it. Okay, it's sort of like a circle. If I stood here and walked in this direction, and kept walking in this direction, apart from you obviously think I'm a fool at about 30 feet here because of the concrete wall. If I could walk, I could walk forever around the earth, right? I could walk forever and never hit an end. I would not hit an edge, right? But I would just end back up where I started, right? Right. It looks unbounded. There's no walls there. There's no edges, right? But it's finite. I'm not going to get off the planet. And the universe is apparently like that, too. You can just go and go and go and go and go. You leave Peoria, and you end back up at Peoria. Okay? You don't get anywhere. And so it's a finite little thing in here. We're caught in this little bubble, this thing called the universe. And it is, but it's still finite. So look at the verse here. Behold, I will create a new heavens and a new earth. In other words, it's temporary. It's passing through as well. There's going to be a new one. Next verse. That day will bring about the destruction of the heavens by fire, and the elements will melt in the heat. But in keeping with his promise, we are looking forward to a new heaven and a new earth, the home of righteousness. The older you get, the more the home of righteousness means to you. This would be a lot better place if everybody were righteous. I mean, work would be different. I mean, it would be a nice kind of deal, okay, if they were righteous. So we're looking for a home of righteousness. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away. It was just a temporary thing. We've got to recognize this. It's temporary. Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil, you will eat of it all the days of your life. It will produce thorns and thistles for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your brow, you will eat your food until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you will return. Okay, the point was there, it's messed up a little bit, too. In other words, we did some things way back a long time ago that sort of threw some mess into the system. The mobile was in perfect balance, and we decided we were going to change it. We were going to fix it. We were going to tweak it ourselves. And then the thing doesn't work anymore. Now it's out of balance, and we go over here and we try to correct it here, and it tips back this direction. You can't ever sort of get it back together again. We've cut one of the little jigsaw pieces wrong, and you can't ever get the puzzle back together again like you'd like. You know, it's that kind of model. There's something out of kilter with it, and it's a little frustrating. And that's the next verse. Romans 8, the creation waits in eager expectation for the sons of God to be revealed. For the creation was subjected to frustration, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay. In other things, right now we know that things run down. Just right now, there's decay in our universe. It just happens. I go home, I'm a single dad, and the house needs dusting on a regular basis. I don't do anything to it. It just, dust just gets there. Where does it come from? I don't know. I can't figure it out. I clean the vents. I clean the ducts. I tape them up. I gag them. Dust gets there. Something's wearing down. Erosion occurs. If I don't pay attention to my relationship with my kids, they decay. If I don't pay attention to my relationship with God, it gets stale. There's that old saying about the virtuoso pianist, right? That's the concert pianist. That if they miss practice one day, they can tell. If they miss it 2 days, their coach can tell. If they miss it 3 days, their audiences can tell. Okay? In other words, you have to catch these early. The old saying about keeping short accounts with God. Keep short accounts with God. Okay? And don't let it filter down into reality. But decay happens here, and we would like this not to be the case. We don't want those little signs. Litter cleanup for the next 3 miles belongs to Glenn Miller. We don't want those. We literally want it not to do that. We don't want to have to mess with decay. The wolf will live with the lamb. The leopard will lie down with the goat. The calf and the lion and the yearling together, and a little child will lead them. Something is seriously out of kilter in the world of nature. We know this. We know it, especially in the last 20, 30 years of our lives, because a lot of the publicity it gets, the ecology and things of this type. But they could have answered this, they could have told you this back when the lions were eating people in Israel. Okay? The principle has been there for the longest time. Okay? Something's out of kilter, relationships are broken, they need work, some things have to be changed. And that's what we long for and what the creation longs to do. Okay? Next point, next page. So it's temporary, it's going to pass away, and it's not completely healthy. It has more good than bad, so it's 51% or more good, or else we couldn't even actually talk about it. That's a separate problem. And good and evil would sort of be reversed. So it's basically good. There's just some tweaks in the system. There's some things that are run amok. There's some trouble on the phone line, that distorts the message a little bit and things of this type. Okay? Now, only part of the universe is visible to us. Now, look at a couple of these. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation, for by him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible. So the universe has things that are visible to us and things that are invisible to us. Okay? There are things that are measurable by us, like gravity, but I can't see gravity. I can see the effects of gravity, but I can't see it. So a lot of forces and fields, we call them, whatever those are things that we sort of can't see. Okay? But there are other things in this particular case look like that they were intelligences. Okay? Look at the next one. When the servant of the man of God got up and went out early the next morning, an army with horses and chariots had surrounded the city. Oh, my Lord, what shall we do? The servant asked. Now, that was a legitimate question, perfectly rational response to this. This is the Assyrian army that has surrounded these people and are about to just decimate them. The Assyrians were not known for their benevolence in wartime experiences. Don't be afraid, the prophet answered. Those who are with us are more than those who are with them. Click, click. Okay. Now, we got about 4 or 5 here in this on the Israelite camp, and then we've got this army out there of Assyria. And Elisha prayed, O Lord, open his eyes, the servant, so he may see. Then the Lord opened the servant's eyes, and he looked and saw the hills full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. All right, now, so look at this picture. I mean, consider the scenario. We normally run around life, and we have this filter on. We're built just mortal filters. There's so many things we see. There's so many things that we know and we do that we don't even see. We have this unconscious that really is unconscious. We don't see in there. It's unconscious, but it does things. We all know. Okay. In the case of seeing things, here was a situation where there were literally spiritual intelligences somehow surrounding this mountain that nobody could see. Apparently, Elisha could see these, or at least knew that they were there. We don't know that Elisha even saw them. It could have been a faith thing, for all we know, where God said, I've surrounded the mountain with these intelligent beings, these agents. They're going to help in this wartime. And it could be that Elisha said, well, show them to me, God. He probably did. He probably said, I trust you. Let's go ahead. But he had a little doubting Thomas there, his little servant. He said, well, hey, it's time to do a lesson on this guy. Time to teach him something about your grace so he won't have to ask ever again about this and hold up the program. See, they were supposed to go ahead about it. We had to stop for a little diversion and do a little pedagogy, a little teaching to the servant. Right? So, okay, Lord, would you open his eyes? He opens his eyes and he sees all this stuff. Right? So they're out there. There had to be this special little thing, and probably the curtain fell back down, and they went up. God doesn't. He's not a P.T. Barnum. He doesn't run a 3-ring circus. He's not always out there doing all this stuff to get applause. He's trying to build images of his son quietly, steadily, through goodness, through grace, quietness. Just doesn't go for the real spectacular. He doesn't really want to scare us a whole lot, actually. That's part of the rationale for this. Then you got the next one. A little later, another story, actually. As the enemy came down toward them, Elisha prayed to the Lord, strike these people with blindness. So he struck them with blindness, as Elisha had asked. And down toward the end, the Lord opened their eyes, right? Now, and this is a common refrain, and the Lord opened their eyes. You see this a lot in Scripture. You'll see it in a number of passages. He just cuts this on and off somehow. We don't know how vision works, period. God knows how to cut it on and off, just flipping the switch. Okay. We know of psychosomatic disorders, for example, where we will just simply block it out. I mean, we're getting all the data, all the stuff's coming in the retinal images, it's firing off the neural cortex, everything's working, but we don't see anything. We just don't see anything from a medical standpoint. It's called neglect. There are various types of disorders there are, all in the consciousness set. So God wants to say, flip a switch? Nope. That's his business. He can do it, and does it on a regular basis. And in this case, he opens it up and lets a little bit more of the data through, and he lets them see these angels of fire on the mountainside. Okay. The next verse. We come fast forward thousands of years, right? Dear friends, now we are the children of God, and what we will be has not been yet made known. But we know that when he appears, we will be like him, because we will see him as he is. To see God the way he is, you have to be changed. There's something different about us, about the way we do things and see things and process data or whatever, that has to change. But once that does, we get to see God as he is. Okay? We haven't seen him yet. We have seen his glory in the person of Jesus Christ. But visions. Now, also, when God reveals things from the supernatural dimension, okay, he normally, and we'll see this in spades when we get to bus stop 3, he normally likes to use people for this. Apparently, he likes to have one of you come up to me and teach me something, okay, instead of him writing it in the sky or doing something clever like that, spectacular. Because what he wants me to do is build some level of dependence upon you. He wants me to thank you and then turn around and thank him, see, for the way this thing works, see. He wants to build community. So, it'd be faster for him just to do a surgical implant of all this information. But he wouldn't get what he wanted out of this thing. I'd just be even more of a lone ranger than I might already be. See, but he's trying to build community, so he will deliberately block it in my head so I can't figure it out. I'll sit there and look at the same verse over and over and not see it. And then you'll come up and say, look what the Lord showed me today. And I'll say, same God? How's he being stingy to me? I may go get bitter on him about this, but that's a separate issue. Point being is that he does this stuff to see fit according to his good pleasure, the way he approaches these things. Okay, so only part of it's visible. He'll do visions. Sometimes he'll actually do visions inside heads. He spoke to kings through dreams. He's got a number of special techniques that he used generally for leadership. He did a lot of dreams to kings, just special situations where he did it. Normally he just lets it go, and we're supposed to encourage one another and things of this type. But it's a constant refrain that he opens the eyes. So this universe, I'm just talking to my buddy Lambert back here, about 26 dimensions. We got all these things that are supposed to be in this universe that we can't get to from here. Okay, and it's so obvious we do live in such a narrow little subset of the universe. We really do. I mean, we can only see certain wavelengths of radiation and light. I mean, we're so limited, literally, in what we process. I've often thought that if we were different kinds of creatures, if I couldn't see a tree, and nobody could see trees, if I bumped into a tree and didn't see anything there, I would probably think it was a field, like a magnetic field or something weird, a force field. See what I'm saying? In other words, our perspectives on things are so really narrow, compared to what all of reality really is. I mean, we have such a little niche of the truth, about the universe. It's amazing, especially for as arrogant as we tend to be on behalf of that information that we know. But I don't want to get into that yet. Arrogance comes up later. Some of you may want to jump off the bus before we get to the arrogance section, but I'll give you advance notice about that. Okay. Interconnected. It's all interconnected. In other words, the universe is a universe. Verse meaning diversity, lots of different things, and uni meaning one. We made one out of all this stuff, which, like a mobile, okay, you mess one piece up or you change one piece, it affects just about everything else. Like a little wave. like one of those little waves, and if you throw another wave in there on top of it, you never get the original one ever out again. It always stays together. Everything downstream, we call it, is affected. So I give an example that I talked about last week, gravitational attraction between all things. This is just a physical one. If I made a tennis ball right here, remember, if I just spoke it into existence, it would instantly have gravitational attraction to every other thing in the universe, not just other tennis balls, but everything that has mass, okay, in our current knowledge of the universe, the physical law. Okay, it would instantaneously, in other words, it is built together as a whole. And there are a couple of places that this interconnectedness in the universe show up. The first one I've got here is the dynamics of the body. Familiar passage, talking about the church generally. The eye cannot say to the hand, I don't need you. And the head cannot say to the feet, I don't need you. On the contrary, those parts of the body that seem to be weaker are indispensable. You still got to have them. And the parts that we think are less honorable, we treat with special honor. And the parts that are unpresentable are treated with special modesty. We cover them. While our presentable parts need no special attention. But God has combined the members of the body and has given greater honor to the parts that lacked it so that there should be no division in the body, but that its parts should have equal concern for each other. If one part suffers, every part suffers. See? Just a familiar thing. In the body, if I remember one time, one of the many times God has been trying to teach me this, I broke a finger. I broke my middle finger on my left hand. I fell backwards, tried to catch myself. I had not successfully dieted far enough on this and broke my finger. It could not carry my body weight. So I have to wear one of those little splint things that you can't get wet, right? And washing dishes one-handed is a trick. You throw the thing up, you've only got a few seconds to catch it before you get it. But washing dishes with one hand was a trick. And so I had this thing for 3 weeks. And I'm just, the rest of me is not working up to par. It's not even being effective, okay? Okay, certainly not being efficient, because this one little thing had drug it so far down that I had forgotten how badly I needed that left hand, specifically that finger, to do stuff. I had forgotten all about it. And so this was a long and torturous lesson. You know, I had learned a couple more times since then, but without broken fractures or other types of physiological damage. That's the good news. I'm just slowly getting there. But the point was is that we are, in ways that we're not aware, we are dependent upon one another. And the universe is all tied together, and this is the case the body is. Then there's another set of dependents called the dynamics of the inheritance line. This is the community that we're in, Adam, Christ, Abraham, David, for example. For just as through the disobedience of the one man, the many were made sinners, so also through the obedience of the one man, the many will be made righteous. Now, this is a heavy theological passage, but the point was, is by being linked to Adam or being linked to Christ, we participate in somebody else's benefits one way or the other. In other words, we take part, we step into a stream of something else this way. Okay? The Israelites in Egypt, did God lead them on the Exodus because they were particularly well-behaved? They did it because they were descendants of whom? Abraham. See? They were part of this. There was an inheritance line that came down, benefits, and they just happened to be in the right place at the right time to do this. See what I'm saying? In other words, it fits together. There are downstream implications of everything we do. Okay? The dynamics of family. This is where we experience it, you know, mostly. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sins of the father. Now, follow this, okay? Because this is always an interesting verse. Punishing the children for the sins of the father to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me. Okay, all the generations actually have to hate. It doesn't work if one of them breaks the chain and starts loving God. It all goes away. But all three of them have to go. If they perpetuate after 3 generations, in the ancient Near East, all 3 generations lived in the same house, by the way. This is the extended family. So the father couldn't go off, the grandfather couldn't go off and sell the house, for example, without impacting the grandchildren, right? Because they were going to have to move out. So it was a standard kind of a society where literally it was extended families, and so anything you did upstream affected downstream folk. Okay? But God was gracious enough that I'll even break the chain. If just at the first or second generation, if somebody doesn't hate me, boom, I'll break it. I'll break in what we call an invasion of grace. and I'll start changing things quietly, steadily, and you'll wake up and you'll understand how the factors of your childhood or your home life have screwed you up. But the fact that you understand it and you see health and growth and change, you simply say, this is only God's doing. This is only can be done with God, because it doesn't work this way normally. It just locksteps, right? Absentee fathers breed absentee fathers breed absentee fathers breed absentee fathers, for example. Okay? And so unless somebody draws a line, somebody sits there and says, I'm not going to hate God. He says, do this. I'm going to do this. And God says, you get extra credit, extra help. Call in some of the angels. Let's go. Let's help this. Let's reorganize these. The heart of the king is in the hand of the Lord. Let's change the work environment. Let's change the legal situation. Let's do some things to support righteousness. Okay? The dynamics of the family. But showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me. In other words, this is not symmetric. You only get 3 generations of justice. You get 1,000 generations of grace. 1,000 generations of grace. This is grace, as we talked about in the first session, it's not symmetric. He delights to do this. Justice is his strange work. Remember? His strange work. He does it with displeasure and distaste that he has to do that. Okay? And when we get a little later, we'll see this preeminently in the cause of Jesus Christ. As far as the gospel is concerned, oops, I jumped ahead. Oh, yes. Do not abhor an Edomite, for he is your brother, the sin of Abraham. Do not abhor an Egyptian, because you live as an alien in his country. The third generation of children born to them may enter the assembly of the Lord. So remember, when they left Egypt, some of the Israelites went with them. So some of the Israelites, Egyptians, some of the Egyptians, okay, saw all the stuff that went around and they said, well, you know, I'd rather side with a winning team. So far I've lost my livestock, I've lost my lawn, I've worked on every weekend for the last 6 years. But now it's turned to blood, I've got all these problems. I'm going to side with the winning, so I'm going to go out with them. So that's part of the mixed rabble and multitude. There's a group that goes out with them, some good, some bad, okay, some just being mercenaries, etc. But they go with them, and so you can imagine the racial animosity here between the Israelites and the Egyptians then, slaves, 400 some odd years, right? But does God hold it again? No. He says, look, sorry, third generation, if they're there, you let them in. You let them in. Okay? You were aliens in their house. Don't reciprocate. Don't pay back in kind. Okay? You come back. You be gracious because I am a gracious God. Right? Third generation, get in. So the implication, okay, that it's downstream. As far as the gospel is concerned, they are enemies on your account. But as far as election is concerned, they are loved on account of the patriarchs. See? This is that thing, if you get connected to, I mean, there are times, one of my favorite ministries is Jews for Jesus. I've had a couple of dealings with them, and it's been really sweet, and if you come from the theological persuasion I do, you would kill for one drop of Abraham's blood in you, okay? You would just love to get just a couple of red blood cells would do, because you get full credit in that case, apparently. Because there's especially about being linked into this chain. There's some special promises that go to this nation. It's staggering what has been done through these folk. And we don't, you know, it's because of Abraham. It's literally because of a promise that God made to Abraham. It all comes out of that. It's not their goodness or Abraham's goodness for that matter. You know, for I know Abraham so that he will teach his children. The knowledge of God came first in that particular case. But the family spills over like that. If you look up the next page, you see in Ezekiel. Ezekiel, it's amazing how subtle we humans are at blame shifting. You know, we talked about this. We will find some excuse for this other than accepting responsibility for our action. And in this case, we're in Ezekiel. We're in exile kind of model. We're about to go in exile, or we're there already, and we're saying we're being punished because our fathers did wrong. We're blaming it on our heredity. The genetics. Remember, I told you about the story of that kid that goes in, the fifth graders goes in with a report card to his dad sitting in the sofa, sitting in the easy chair, and it's got all F's on the report card, and he gives it to his dad, and he says, well, Dad, what do you think it is? Heredity or environment? Right? See? you can't win this one if that's the rules of discussion. But kid's going to get off the hook because dad's doing the environment. Dad provided half our heredity. Right? You're not going to win this one, right? And so what happens in the case where you blame it all on antecedent causes, I disappear. The agent disappears. See, the kid's not in that picture anymore, is it? There's no kid there just to say, you should have done better. No, you should have made me do better. You know, you can go this route. I mean, we play these all the time for those of you that have had this experience. You didn't wake me up, Dad, for school. You know, you should. Okay, anyway. Obviously, school just started this past 2 weeks. All right. Point being is that they were blaming it all. And if you look at the syllabus there on the bold, actually, I jumped ahead to Ezekiel 18. This is Jesus is talking to the Pharisees, and the Pharisees, he says, fill up then the measure of your fathers. In other words, the fathers killed all the prophets, so I'm just the next in line. Remember, the strongest piece of sarcasm we have in the New Testament, it rivals Paul at some point, is Jesus' comment. Jesus, right before he goes to Jerusalem for the last time, he says, it's time for us to go to Jerusalem, because it cannot be that a prophet gets killed in any other city except Jerusalem. See, where the religious establishment is, he says, that's where I got to go. It cannot be, I mean, just not right for a prophet of God to be killed outside the city of Jerusalem. Okay? And the point was is that there was a family sort of tradition here among the ruling, a minority of the ruling group within Israel, that they put the prophets to death. Did that stop the prophets? No, not at all. If you look at the prophets in the Old Testament that made it into this book, none of them are government prophets. They fought against government prophets that outnumbered them by two orders of magnitude. Some of them took on groups of 250. Some took on groups of 400 paid government prophets who probably turned out reams and reams of more reports and prophecies than these people did, but which one survived? Right? The little minority group here. Right, those that stood for God. Doesn't matter. Remember we talked about one plus God is the majority? That's a proof of it if you want to see it. You go look at these old prophets, Old Testament prophets, all of whom were killed, to the best of our knowledge, for their belief by that government, but who outlived the government, who outlived all their paid-for political announcements of the prophets. Okay? So this was Jesus' comment. And the last one on this was Ezekiel. But suppose this son, as a son who sees all the sins his father commits. Though he sees him, he doesn't do those things. He keeps my laws and follows his decrees. He will not die for his father's sins. He will surely live. Okay? In other words, the system is set up to where benefits accrue. In other words, if I do good things, okay, my kids get some benefit of that. Right? And this is a good thing, if you think about it. I mean, this is a leverage. I mean, this is a way for us to get some things. It's like putting a dollar in the bank account, you know, at 5% interest. In 73 years, it's $1 million. If you don't take anything out, or, you know, before we get to taxes and stuff. Right? Okay, 73 years is what it takes to turn that to $1 million at just simple compounding interest. Point being is that God built the system for this way so we could take advantage of that. You want to store up stuff for the kids? You want to store up stuff for your friends? You want to store up for those people that you're going to influence down their streams? Right? Just stay after it, day after day after day. Every little thing you do now is like a lever, which is a little bit further out. Remember just the one, I often use the phrase about start an avalanche one rock at a time. You can do, avalanches are generally made out of lots of little bitty rocks. Okay? If you can just do a little rock of righteousness today, a rock of kindness, a rock of goodness, you know, just start your own avalanche so that by the time somebody needs it, they can't run away from it. They can't avoid. You can't stop an avalanche one rock at a time, but you can start one rock at a time. See? If you want to bowl over one of your friends with an avalanche of love and kindness to show them the face of Jesus Christ, one rock at a time. Just a little bit every day, just keep at it. Just keep after it, and eventually the heart melts. How can you stand before the face of a loving God? You just can't. It just melts you. So the system works. We're all interconnected, and that's a leverage thing. We can do good or we can do bad with this. We can mess this up rather seriously, as we know. Dysfunctional families that don't have an invasion of grace on a regular basis to keep it in kilter, and to start tearing down some of the decay, it's catastrophic. It can be a very difficulty. The dynamics of fixed laws. Number five, can a man scoop fire into his lap without his clothes being burned? In other words, that's the predictability we talked about. Okay, the laws do work. If a lot of people will sow wild oats and then pray for a crop failure, right? Okay, see, it's going to work. You're going to reap what you sow. Okay, and that's the law. And like I say, you're supposed to take advantage of that. That's a promise, not a curse, right? That says in due time we will reap. If we don't give up, just keep sowing. And you get more back than you put in the ground. Remember, it's the 50-fold, 70, 100-fold, all that stuff, right? You get some leverage in this because that's the way the system works. So you invest a little bit here, and boom, you get more back. So logically, it works like that, okay? And then the last piece under this is the agent-universe connection. And by this, I mean the fact that we are agents within this universe, meaning we have the ability to do things to it for good or ill, okay? The verse here, cursed is the ground because of you through painful toil. You will eat of it all the days of your life. It will produce thorns and thistles for you. In other words, we did something. We injected some negativity into the universe. Okay, and we reap what we sow. We threw that out of ground. Out of kilter. And then we got the next verse there, the fear and dread of you will fall upon the beast of the earth. The point here, we're not going to get too heavy into this ecology, but things are broken down because of the choices we made and the choices we still make. We still do a lot of this stuff. Okay, we antagonize the universe, we antagonize relationships and things of this type. And sometimes we do it deliberately, frankly. Just, you know, we're having a bad day, you know, and somebody walks into the line of fire. You know, this kind of deal, right? And so we have to recognize that there is this, we do have, when we talk about our responsibility under the cultural mandates in Genesis, okay, where we were made to be gardeners and stewards and rulers over this universe and all that it produces, everything from gardens to architectural designs, you know, and luminescence, quantum phenomena, and luminescent dials, you know, we're stewards of that. We have to answer for that at some level. But we had better understand that the system is sort of broken to bring in healing to it. We got to start treating this a little bit better. That doesn't mean you have to read Bible verses to your plant. I'm not getting at that level of detail yet. Okay, you might try to. You know, the studies are inconclusive at this point. Okay, and then point I, and I think we're going to have to sort of wrap at that point. Point I is that this universe that we've looked at is inhabited by other centers of awareness. Okay, I give the example of angels. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For by him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities. All things were created by him and for him. There are intelligences far beyond ours in this universe that we have to deal with sometimes. We are not equipped to deal with them. We can't see them. We don't know much about them. They are much smarter than us. Okay? We have to do a relationship with the person that's revealed himself to us, and that's Jesus Christ. If you want any protection at all against angelic, spiritual things, you have no prayer but the cross. You cannot defend yourself, period. I remember one of the days that I thought I was smart. This was back in, I guess it would have been 79. I was a third year. A seminary student had done something particularly clever, I thought. And I was on my way to work at the Health Science Center. I was a computer type there. And I remember thinking about this, and then it dawned on me. I was having a few minutes of quiet time before going to work in the car. And it just dawned on me. I'd read some passage where if a malignant intelligence, an evil angel, decided to into some truth, there would be no stopping. There'd be no defense, and they would make me feel proud about my discovery. There would be no defense against that level of deception. Period. I have no defense. And so very, very quickly, it depends upon how fast you are, how much sleep you've had, you quickly throw yourself on the mercies of God. you quickly say, got it. Now I know why you say don't deal with witchcraft, because you open yourself up to spiritual intelligences that you can't control. You don't know where they've been. You don't know anything about these folks, other than you have opened yourself up to a false god, which is dangerous. Play it safe and fall into the hands of a God who loves you. Right? So I learned very quickly, you don't mess with these folks. Okay? You don't do some of the stranger new age things and the chant, you know, all these other little intelligence stuff. So how good they look or how friendly they act or how much money they pay you, okay, to do the test. Be careful. You've got to be careful. They are out there in the universe and we have to deal with them. They're, of course, people. We're generally conscious most of the time. And then there are animals that are called on the threshold of personhood. Puppies that play, loyalty of a pet, they have a certain limited amount of companionship that we can have with them, actual fun with them, communication, things of this type, but they're not all the way there. They're not all the way back. But fortunately, they don't give me a lot of lip. You know, they don't push back real hard. Some of those bred for violence dogs do. That's a separate problem. But the thing is, we are in this universe. It is all tied together. There are other agents out there that we have to do business with. But the fact that the choices you will make this week will affect something so downstream, not only in your own character, but in your relationships, in your domicile where you live, in your office where you work, and people 100 million years from now, perhaps. Okay? You just never know the little things you do, and so you ought to not be scared by that, but you ought to take advantage of that. That's an awesome thing. Just a single smile can do a tremendous amount of damage. Okay? Just a patience can do a tremendous amount of hard heart erosion in somebody's life. Tremendous leverage here because he built it this way. And as we'll talk later, we actually end up getting rewarded for this stuff. So that's we're not through with the universe yet. We've only covered 2/3 of the universe, so we've still got a little bit further to go. But let's close in a word of prayer right quick. Father, we thank you so much for this universe, for the creation through your Son, for your Son. It's a delight to us. It's beautiful, all the things you've built into this for us to see and enjoy and praise you. We appreciate the opportunities that you give us to create beautiful things, beautiful works of art in other people's lives, smiles, music, poetry, goodness, elegance, stability. Help us take advantage of this, the way you created this, Lord. Give us the heart with your Spirit to see that which is good and see that which is best and to focus on building those things in our lives and the lives of others. We thank you so much because we'd like to offer this up to your Son at the end of time as something that reflects him, reflects his glory, and something that he can be pleased with. We ask this for his sake. Give us a good week along these ends. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay. All right. Let's see.